This is the Cultural Fluency Podcast with Angèle Préteau, the French coach. That is me. And today in episode number 17, I am with Adam Liet. Did I say that right? Yes? Okay. And you are the founder and director of Smooth Operations, which helps entrepreneurs create the systems and workflow needed to scale online companies. And you've had a really interesting life until this point. So can you please introduce yourself for the people who don't know you yet?
Thank you so much for having me. It's a wonderful morning. I'm always love to talk about this stuff. Life has been a series of turns. To cut it real short, was a professional musician trained in classical music, joined the army for about 12 years, went active duty, went all around the world, seeing lots of interesting places, mostly Southeast Asia, learned a couple of different languages, met a lot of different people. That jump started me into starting to work online. So I was working remote, started about 7 years ago, working for a British company. And that ended up catapulting me into a career where I help entrepreneurs do what I did, which is grew that company to from like $400,000 a year to almost $5 million a year in revenue.
Wow.
So now that's what numbers. I do is, yeah, big numbers. Requires growing a team, requires leveling up your own understanding and your own appreciation and way of approaching people. So I always tell people, I don't care what business you're in, you're in the people business first.
Right, absolutely. And
that's what leadership is really about.
All right, thank you. You've answered a couple of the questions I had and spawned maybe five or six more, so I'll try to ask them. When we first came in touch, you told me you learned Indonesian fluently, but right now you just said a couple languages. Can you elaborate?
Yes. Yeah, Indonesian, though, when you're in the army, I was in special operations, and we get what they call target language, where you're going to be specialized in one language. And so I learned Indonesian in the US. We had an Indonesian teacher. It was like a 4 or 5 month school where every day, the moment you got out of your car at the base, you were speaking Indonesian for the rest of the day. It was immersion learning. And so I learned that and ended up going to Indonesia, working at the U.S. Embassy for about 2 years. But I went to other countries in Asia as well. So one of those was Thailand. And it was very much
you learned Thai.
Very much an immersion experience where I was living with Thais, working with Thais. So you're going to pick up some of the language, but I picked it up in a different way because I wasn't in an academic setting. So I never learned to read Thai. I can't read script to this day. But and so as a result,
notoriously impossible, right?
Well, it's not if you are learning in the academic setting. A friend of mine learned in the same way I learned Indonesian, and he's really good because I just learned by rote, by repeating and saying things back. I was able to get around. I mean, I could easily speak Thai for a good part of the day by the time I went home, but I didn't retain it. So now it's like very minimal, but when I was there, I was able to learn it really well.
That is impressive. I tried to learn Thai myself because I went to Thailand for a month at some point. I could barely communicate with a taxi driver, and I was tricked at the beginning because Thai is written with an alphabet. And I've learned maybe four or five alphabets, you know, previously to that experience. And I thought, an alphabet, you know, how hard can it be? It's the worst alphabet I've ever seen in my life.
Yes.
What? Are you sure it's even an alphabet? Like the amount of little like accents and stuff. But so Indonesian and English. That's impressive.
Yeah. I remember at one point we were working on some slides together. I had an interpreter and I just changed the font on the slides and like, you messed it all up now. It doesn't read right. Cause they don't even put spaces in between their words.
Yes.
And it's like, I can't even change the font. Okay. Retranslate. Let's go.
Yes. That's brings some memory for me too.
And then I like to joke that I learned British. And be like, well, that's English. Well, not really. British is very different.
Yeah.
So when I was working for a British company, I wouldn't speak British so much, but I did so much of our copywriting and our marketing materials.
Oh, wow.
I got really fluent at typing British.
with the use, the extra use and stuff.
All the extra characters, some of the tone, like the way we would speak in our marketing copy. And there were little tricks I learned to make that a little easier for myself. But when I left that British company, it took a while to unprogram myself from typing in British.
Right. Yeah, because you learn to not just speak and write the way that British people do, but actually write copy for them, which, you know, I learned copywriting in English, mostly American English. It's not my native language. I'm actually French. But somehow it feels even harder to me, like when if I try to project myself to write copy in a different kind of English as opposed to an entirely different language. See what I mean? It just sounds really hard.
Yeah, it was difficult because I was the same way. I learned it in English, American English, and then like translating, I'm like, okay, well, this is your job now, figure it out. But I think that's part of the professionalism of the whole thing is like, treat it like it's your job because it is. You approach things with that professional mindset. You know, it's just a different way of going about things. And I've always found that flip in the head that we do is like, you have to, because this is what you do. Right. That's always been really effective for me, just to pour through it and get rid of whatever hangups you have over it and just accept it.
I know that there are people in my audience who are very fond of the differences between British culture and American culture and like finding out little things. Can you recall a couple of things that for you were interesting or quirky at that time? Do you have stories for that?
The biggest one was like the interjections. So America would be like, okay, great. British would be fab.
Fab.
Like fab.
All right.
And like it's fabulous. The same thing. Yeah. And some of the little ways that they would. It's always the idiosyncrasies. Like, oh, get your knickers in a twist. Like you never say that in America. No one knows what you're talking about. And you say it over there. And they're like, oh, yeah, probably the weirdest one. And I don't know if what was the word. It was a word that's very, very offensive in America. And they just use it all the time. And now I might have purposely blocked it from my memory so I don't ever say it in an American context, because now I work for an American company, work mostly with Americans.
Right.
And I think I purposely blocked it from my mind.
It's okay. You don't have to recall it. I'm afraid it's going to be bad for you if you do.
Right. Yeah, yes. It was always the little things. And but those are the fun colors in the language. And and when you learn those little colors, that's when you know you're becoming very culturally attuned to things. One particular moment I remember, I was in a mall in Indonesia, and this little boy like came into the mall, and I was in the middle of nowhere on the island of Sulawesi, doing some traveling, and they have a phrase that they use for foreigners called bule, is what they would call foreigners, but it's not a polite word.
It's not a polite word in French if you use that for a person either, so I'm not sure if it's the same, but maybe they got it from us. It's possible.
Maybe.
A bule in French is, it's the word is like what you use for a cannonball. And traditionally, if you for prisoners, if you didn't want them to go very far, you would tie them to tie one of those cannonballs to their ankle, right? It's like a old thing to do. And because of that, if you call someone un boulet, it's just someone who's like sticking around with you that you have to carry, and it is really just like weighing you down. That's what it means in French. So I don't know if they got it from us, but maybe they did. You know, those are like places that were colonized by the French. Quite extensively as well. So maybe.
Maybe
that's what it means.
Who knows? This little boy stops, he looks at me, and he points and he goes, "Bule, bule, bule." And the mother looks so embarrassed. And I'm just, she's like, so started apologizing. I'm like, it's okay. Hey, man, what's up? He was just, he had probably heard it before and picked it up. And this little 3-year-old just starts pointing at me and yelling, "Bule." It was hilarious.
That is cute. It's a cute story. I have one question. You said you were in the Army Special Operation. I need to ask for the international audience, what are the special operations? What's special?
Yeah. So Special Operations does a variety of different jobs around the world. When we think of special operations from the Hollywood perspective, we'll think of the Navy SEALs or like those types of units that do more of the bang bang stuff. Mm-hmm. I was in a particular unit called psychological operations. We were more focused on the mind and culture and really trying to make a positive difference in the world through information. Mm-hmm. So when I would be working in a place like Indonesia, I would be working not only with the U.S. Embassy, but with my partner nation forces in the Indonesian government, working on broader peace initiatives where our weapon was information.
Right.
So I did some of the cool guy stuff as far as jumping from planes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But my biggest weapon was my laptop and my pen and my brain. So trying to make that positive difference in the world.
Right. So I can see how that segues in then working in operations and working with people and with entrepreneurs, right? Because you still have to like influence their minds quite extensively, I'm guessing, as part of this work, right?
Oh, absolutely. Influence is everything. How you're approaching things, how you're framing things. It's often a runway to how you're doing things. I like to call that, I don't call it. Robert Cialdini calls it persuasion, where if you want a decision to be made, you start working on getting that decision made well before the decision
before you ask
is
the
to
question,
be made.
Right? Yes.
Exactly. And so now in part of my line of work where I'm working to get someone to get ready to make that decision, because a lot of us come with hangups. We come with our own things that hold us back. And mm-hmm. so I'm working on overcoming those things, getting people to overcome their own stuff.
Right.
And a lot of times it takes some very, very just small nudges along the way. So when the decision to be made is finally there, they're ready to jump. And it's always for something that's good for them. So I have clients that are afraid of getting on Zoom or afraid of getting on Facebook Live, which is to me weird, but you can't think that way. You have to put that out of your mind because it's not your experience that matters. It's theirs. And so you just work on very subtle ways of getting them to see it in a different light. Mm-hmm. And then when the time comes to hit that live button, they're not only able to do it, but they're able to do it with confidence and excitement.
That makes total sense. And it's something that will apply to really everyone in their life, whether they have to convince themselves to do something or convince someone else. Like, you know, when you mentioned, you know, Zoom on or Facebook Live, I see it with the people who work with me. Some people will contact me first. And well, I guess even to get to the point where they contact me, there's a lot of like that situation already. But then they come in touch with me and I go, I want to work one-on-one with you. And I tell them, okay, great. You were also invited to our group class. And they go like, oh, no. And it's not good for, and because also a lot of the people I work with are introverts, because I'm an introvert myself, so we can attract each other. But I try to encourage them to really show up for the group class. And eventually they do, it just takes a while because those classes are so helpful as well for the students, you know, like it's really a great complement to working one-on-one. So actually, maybe I'll ask you the question for myself, like, what can I do to help make that process smoother, either, you know, for them from the moment when they work with me to just actually joining the class or joining the class more regularly? Because, you know, they are paying for it anyway. It would be better if they would get the full benefit, right?
Absolutely. So let me ask in particular, is the main hang up getting them to show up on Zoom in the first place? Or is it when they show up on Zoom, they're not present or they have their camera off, or what is the main?
No, it's mostly just getting them to show up. And the camera is not a big problem with me. Like, people have their camera off all the time. Not all of them, of course, but it's fine. It works either way.
Gotcha.
Yeah. They're afraid of speaking in front of other people. At first they're afraid of speaking in front of me, but I do manage to convince them, at least they're convinced before they show up, right, that it's okay, I'm not going to judge them or otherwise make it worse for them, which is unfortunately a thing that too many language teachers do. But the group is a bit of a hang up because, you know, maybe they have bad memories of previously trying to be in a group or something like that.
And that's probably where it's coming from. It's they're hanging on to a previous bad experience. So with that, gosh, how can we overcome that? I would ask some probing questions during your one-on-ones on like what, now that I'm saying it out loud, that's funny about speaking out loud. You think of a good idea, then you say it out loud, and you're like, no, that's not a good idea. Never mind.
Well, maybe I can rephrase it generally to people having an issue with speaking to others, especially in a foreign language. And if you ask that more general question, maybe that works better. I don't know. Like, I mean, obviously, you have done it because you've done Indonesian and Thai. And if you had an issue with speaking, then you definitely overcame it. So is it just because you were in the army and you had no choice?
Part of it was I genuinely wanted to. I think that was the main driver, was the desire was already there. So once the fire's there, it's going to ignite, your show up ability. I would say for the group classes, when you're queuing those up, are you just saying group lesson, we're coming, or everyone show up here? Or are you providing a carrot? Are you giving them a vision of what's to come during the group class? Hey, we're going to cover this. Have you always wondered this about language? We're going to cover it on the group call. Be sure you're there.
Right.
If we find those motivators and we find something that someone's genuinely going to be like, oh, that's it for me. And they're going to pull themselves over the finish line, because that desire to learn what you're going to present on is going to be a huge carrot to get them to just, okay, I have to do this.
I will have to think about how that applies to me, because I'm not actually presenting during group classes. Like, all the presentation that I do, I record it, and then they can just see it for themselves. During the group classes, it's really them speaking. Like, I have organized it in a way that everybody gets a time to speak, and they ask questions to each other. But I can build on the spirit of that and use it, absolutely.
I think the other thing you could do is, this is almost a sales tactic, if you're thinking of like bottom of funnel, middle of funnel, you have to think of a middle of funnel tactic for this versus bottom of funnel. Middle of funnel could be something from you, whether it be a long form podcast or video or blog article, something like that, of how much more your language is accelerated by speaking in front of other people.
Okay.
And even after someone joins you, they're a paying client, you're still nurturing them. So maybe you just interject that middle of funnel type of content into whatever drip feed that you have to get them to see how whatever
idea.
They're paying for, they're going to 10x their own results by speaking in front of other people.
Right. That makes absolute sense. Okay, let's circle back to like less geeky topic, because I think we'll have time to geek out on that on your own podcast, which we're recording soon. So I think those both will be released roughly at the same time. What are lessons that people could take for their own life? Everybody needs to be selling something all the time. There's this book by Daniel Pink, To Sell Is Human, where he argues that even if you're not in sales, you are. Just like you said, like if any business that you are in is the people business. How can people get better at convincing themselves, or perhaps convincing others? Like, if someone would feel that they're not going anywhere in these directions, maybe they're a self-starter and they manage to start themselves, but they can't at all convince others. Can you give us a little hints of things that they could do to help get better at that?
You're better at the selling and influencing aspect. Yeah. I would say the best thing is just continuous practice. Even if you think you aren't doing it, you're doing it on a regular basis. It might just be in small micro doses towards parts of your life.
Right.
You are doing this. I like to make personal challenges for myself and make goals for the week of things I'm going to do and different things I'm going to try, and set those goals at the outset with very deliberate intention. So even in this digital era, I keep a paper planner. I write all my plans for the week on paper.
Yes.
Because there is a connection, even though we're digital people now, this pen that I'm holding in my hand and this pad of paper makes something a different level of commitment.
I'm with you completely. Like,
Yes, exactly. So right.
Yeah.
And what Maya thinks I'm crazy. She's like, you spend $20 a month on a paper planner. Yes. Don't you have a computer? Yes.
That's the process. No. That's actually really interesting. Well, maybe just finish your thoughts and then we can circle back on that.
Absolutely.
So you said you were setting goals for yourself.
It's not going to happen accidentally. You're not going to trick yourself into doing it. It has to be with intention. If you've decided this, or if you know this needs to be a part of what you're going to be doing, you set those goals, you work on them. And here's the real hidden trick is practice. Mm-hmm. And when I say practice, I don't mean live. I mean, actually practice your conversations. So I have a hidden weapon. My most powerful weapon is this phone and this wonderful little tool we have called voice record.
Right.
So on my voice record, no one will ever hear what's on this thing. And there's like 300-400 recordings on this thing. Mm-hmm. Because if I'm getting ready to go into engagement where I need to be influential, where I'm working to achieve a desired result, I will lay out my case, work on my discussion beforehand on paper, and then I will literally pace around my office practicing into my phone my actual conversation. I'll mm-hmm. go back, listen to it, make critiques of myself. I'll go practice again. This is one of the very important things I learned from being a musician that has stayed with me forever. There will be no substitute ever for live practice.
Right.
So actually saying it out loud the first 2-3 times are going to be awkward as can be, and you're going to listen mm-hmm. back and cringe. That's the point. Get the cringe
that
out of the
sense.
Way.
Yeah.
If you have to have a confrontational argument, get all your F-bombs and all your bad words out of the way and all your anger right. out of the way in the recordings that you do in the practice. So when you have to do it for real, you've already offloaded that. You've right. already done your awkward phase. You've already done your anger phase, and you're able to approach the actual conversation with intention.
That is a great tip. Definitely a great, great tip. I don't think I've really ever heard it said so clearly. Well, like it's like being a musician or a sports person. It's just like do it, then watch it or listen to it. And mm-hmm. then, you know, until you're good at it, that is great. I'll definitely take that for myself. I want to circle back to the question of paper because I'm absolutely convinced, but so many people aren't. I'm quite lucky that I work with people that are not too young. Like most of them are older than me. They're in their 40s and it works mm-hmm. for them. Like they understand because they've learned, you know, like myself, when I was in school, I didn't have a computer. So it comes natural to us, but people who are younger, it doesn't really come natural to them. So can you speak a little bit? Why do you spend $20 a month on your paper planner? I use a paper
really?
Planner and also yeah. Google Calendar. Like I use both. And they work together,
yeah.
but people think I'm nuts.
I didn't start. I use Google Calendar to get the reminder, and then I have the Zoom links and right. everything there. The paper planner came from I got into a coaching relationship with a business coach who did mm-hmm. that too, and he got me started in it. And in my mind, I'm like, well, he's worth like $140 million, so obviously he's doing something right.
Yeah.
But since doing it, what I found is, when I do that type of planning, either my daily planning or my weekly planning, it's with a different mindset.
Right.
And I put everything aside. I go into this area of introspectiveness. And I get rid of the distractions.
Right.
And
no electronics.
Just electronics.
The paper and you and the pen.
I don't listen to music. I don't do any of the background white noise that I often have on. I allow myself right. the permission to work on myself.
Almost like a meditative practice.
Oh, yeah, very much so. And I think in this era where everything is digital, taking the time to write something out by hand, most of us have terrible handwriting. So right. when you slow it down to write it well so you can read it later, you're slowing down your processes. You're taking the noise out of your own life. And now that I said that word out loud, I think that might be the biggest thing.
Mm-hmm. When
you're a high performer, you have a lot of noise surrounding yes. you on a regular basis. The biggest challenge we face as high performers is how to minimize that noise. Right. If we can find ways to put purposeful things around us that take away that noise, now we're able to do it on demand. And right. It's the big difference. There's this one book I read called The War of Art. It's a fantastic book. And it's all about facing the resistance and how to really be a professional.
Right.
And the difference between...
Yeah, I remember that book too. Is it Pressfield who wrote it?
Pressfield, yes.
Right, right.
One thing Pressfield said was, the amateur waits to be inspired. The professional does the work.
Right, sits on every day, does the work, and most of it is bad, but it's okay. Keep the nuggets.
Right. Yeah. And so when I think of my career, I was a songwriter for a while, and I was very much an amateur songwriter because I never got past the point of needing to be inspired.
Right.
What I'm trying to do on a consistent basis in my professional life is get over it and find the little things that you can purposely do around yourself to push you into that professional mode. And for me, the paper planner has become one of those. And the way I plan, where I sit, how I will close off the world for that 20 to 30 minutes, it's become very much a part of my routine. And I do it now without thinking.
Do you do that every week or like even every day?
Every day and every week. So every Sunday morning is my weekly planning. I'll grab a cup of coffee. I'll close myself into my den and turn off the outside world for 30 minutes to plan my week. Every day, I actually plan at the end of the day. So that's the last thing I do before closing up shop for the night is I'll plan for the next day. And so when I wake up, I already have my list and everything I'm going to do, the intention I'm going to have for the day. And then close out the day with what was I grateful for? What did I excel at today? Where did I win before I wrap things up today?
That sounds also a lot like what Brendan Bouchard recommends. Something you worked also with him or like with his book at least.
I imagine my coach. So all of this, the planner I use, my coach, he sells his own planner. So I've been buying his planner now for about 5 years. And he probably learned that from Brendan or someone like Brendan, I'm sure.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. I think we are almost at the 30 minutes mark. Mm-hmm. Is there any other thing you'd like to share with our audience? What can you help people with? What kind of level must people be at to start working with you? Like if they're just starting their business, it's too early, or is it?
No, it's not. Really? I do work with several startups to help them get off the ground and start doing things right from the get-go. Mm-hmm. When you think about business operations, often we'll think about org charts and everything. Well, marketing is an operation. It's a system.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I do teach people how to create marketing systems. So marketing is not by happenstance, but it's by intention. The biggest piece of advice I can give to anyone that's looking to either get into online business or start working in this space is that we are not in the world is indeed flat and the world has opened up and you are going to be interacting with people in every country,
right?
So every culture. And that's where I think there's a nice tie-in with language. Even if you don't learn the language, there's something to be said about learning and appreciating their culture and the little things that make them unique and special. And the trick is to stop looking at every culture from the prism of your own and allowing their cultural specialties to be what they are. They're special and unique and wonderful. And if you can see things through the lens of the people that you're working with and try to put yourselves in their shoes and stop trying to make these comparisons, just appreciate it for what it is. You don't have to understand it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to think it's okay. You don't have to think it's great, but just accept the fact that it is.
Right.
I think that once you pass that first barrier and just accept, well, it just is what it is. Mm-hmm. You've already crossed a big gap.
Yeah, and I agree.
I think what holds
it's really
us
challenging,
back,
but it's so, so valuable to do. Absolutely.
Yeah. Like one thing they did in Indonesia with me was, well, I did this myself. Thailand, they do it too, where they will drink the blood of a cobra because they believe it gives them strength.
Interesting.
And so I, of course, did it several times. And everyone's like, well, why did they do that? I'm like, because they do. Right. Well, why did
it's
you do
that
it?
Culture.
Like,
Yeah.
yeah. So why did you do it? I'm like, well, if you're going to be in Asia, go be in Asia. I mean, you can't do this anywhere in the world. It's an experience and you can just share in it. Do you have to understand it? No, you're not going to understand it because you're not from there. And there's stuff we do they don't understand either.
Absolutely.
And if we can all get over that and just be like, oh, it just is what it is. And it feels like so simple just to make that leap. But I have found it allows me to be more curious. It allows me to come to at least to a level of appreciation much faster. And I will never be in most of these people's countries. I will never be part of their culture, but I can appreciate it from an outsider's perspective. And that will take down gaps. That will take down barriers to where I'm working with you in a professional manner. Like my VAs in the Philippines, I can really appreciate the Philippines. I've never been there, but I understand or I appreciate them from a cultural level and the things that they do, what makes them special. And that just, it takes down gaps, takes down barriers. And even for us as individuals, it makes us more astute of the wonderful world we live in.
Well, thank you. I think that is a great piece of advice and I can definitely second that. Where can people find you?
Absolutely. You can find me on my website. It's adamliette.com, www.adamliette. That is a French last name.
I saw that last name. I was like, ooh, you've got some French ancestry there.
The funny thing is, it's one guy. I live in a very, very German part of Ohio in America. Right. Everybody's German. And
except
like,
that one
oh,
guy?
You're French. I'm like, yeah, one guy 5 generations ago was French. The rest of my lineage is German.
They're all German, like, except the one you have the name from. Impressive.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you're French. No, I'm mostly German. I do have a podcast called the Smooth Operator Podcast, where we go deep into detail, really about not only business building, but leading teams and different ways that you can be a better leader, inspire people, motivate them into action, and ultimately win. That's what we're after.
Great. Yeah, we will continue this conversation, in fact, on your podcast, because I'm also invited. I look forward to that conversation. Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining me today, Adam. That was an awesome conversation. And thank you everyone listening to this episode, especially until the end. Please leave a review or a comment, as this will greatly help others find the podcast and will help us get more amazing guests like Adam. I will see you next time.